Hey guys, this is Demon Stealer, and you're listening to the 9-8 Podcast.
Welcome to the 9-8 Podcast, the home of everything progressive and underground right here in Australia. My name is David Ellis, and this week we have a very special interview for you, all the way from India, a good friend of the show now, Demon Stealer. We're going to be going and chatting all about the metal scene and the music scene in general in India, and also talking about something which is probably a little bit left of field, and that is his amazing stardom almost on YouTube through his amazing cooking channel, Headbangers Kitchen. If you're anything like me, you love to cook. I know Hoggy does, and he's got some amazing great keto recipes, actually. If you're thinking about slimming down a little bit after the whole lockdown thing, you probably put on a couple of lockdown kilos like I did. And I started to do a lot of this sort of keto and low carb stuff, which is where I ran into Sahil and his amazing stuff online. So please enjoy this interview. It's a hell of a lot of fun. And yeah, thanks for listening to the 9-8 interview. Sahil, welcome to the 9-8 Podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Hey, no worries at all. No worries. First thing I've got to ask you, how are you situated with COVID and all that? Are you staying safe, your family, your friends, all that kind of stuff? Are you guys, you know, keeping your head down, so to say?
Yeah, luckily we have all been fine since this shit broke out, and we've been staying at home as much as possible and being as safe and precautious as possible.
Awesome.
Luckily for me, I've always worked from home. Well, not always, but well, the last few years I've been working from home. So life hasn't changed too much for me, except the mask and not being able to go grocery shopping like I used to. But yeah, otherwise it's all good.
Yeah, absolutely. It's pretty similar here. I mean, you know, masks and grocery shopping, kind of in lockdown, kind of working from home and so on and so forth. So it's good to hear that everything is okay for yourself, because these are really weird times that we're finding ourselves in.
Yeah, that's true.
So we'll jump in. I mean, first up, thanks for joining us. I mean, I reached out to you on Facebook. I wasn't expecting to get a response, to be really honest with you, because you seem really busy with your YouTube channel, which we'll come to a little bit later on. But for those of our audience who don't know who you are, tell us a bit about yourself, so what you do and what your involvement is with the music scene there in India.
Right. So I'm a heavy metal musician from India. I've been part of the scene here for 2 decades now. I guess I would be most known for my work with my band Demonic Resurrection as the front man of the band. And I've been pretty much involved in every aspect of the music industry in India. I started a record label. I did events. I did PR and marketing. I had a recording studio. I used to produce bands as well. And then later on, that kind of turned into somehow into cooking on YouTube and running a keto channel recipe. So yeah, in a nutshell, that's me.
I mean, from what I can gather, you know, the amount of stuff that you've been involved in over the last 2 decades, you know, you must have seen the scene change quite dramatically from its early days through to, you know, where we're at now. We've got bands like Sky Harbor and so on and so forth coming out of India, or partly coming out of India, part of them from the US as well. You know, but I've heard, and what we hear here in Australia is that the metal scene over in India is actually massive. I mean, is that pretty accurate, or?
Well, yes and no. You know, when you talk about massive, well, India is a massive country, geographically and in terms of population. So it looks like a good market, looks like there's plenty of potential. But in all honesty, the scene is actually quite small. It is limited largely to the metro cities. That's Mumbai, Delhi, Hyderabad, Calcutta. And it is growing. It's not that it's not a growing scene, but it's a bit of a complex equation in India because of the social and economic factors that kind of makes it a very unique scene as compared to other countries, you know. But I think what is sort of universal is the passion of the fans. So the fans are very passionate about the music. They do, you know, really adore the bands they listen to. And that's why when bands come here, they get a fabulous reception. And for the longest time, there was obviously not many bands coming here. So pretty much every band that was in the first wave of international artists to stop by in India got us a very reasonably sized crowd, you know. So they obviously got the impression that there's a massive music scene here. But of course, as the number of shows have increased, you can see the audiences sort of becoming tighter and tighter. But obviously, in that sense, the events have also scaled back. Previously, you know, if there was a big metal band coming down, it had to be like an open air venue with a 5,000 capacity audience. Whereas now you find bands like, you know, Tesseract and all coming and playing, actually playing indoor venues here with a 1,000-person capacity, and and that's sort of working as well. And there are some bands that'll come and play even smaller venues than that. So yeah, it's a good scene. It's a growing scene, but yeah, it's got a lot of work still left.
It sounds very similar to the Australian scene, in that it's still, metal is for some reason still reasonably underground. I kind of can't fathom it, being a big metalhead and a proghead, obviously, hence the podcast. Would it be fair to say that a lot of the stuff over there that sort of hits the airwaves is your, you know, hip hop, techno, trance, dance kind of stuff, pop kind of stuff? Obviously, it would be very different, probably influences to what we would expect here in, say, Australia, United States, etc. There'd probably be some different flavors and so on and so forth thrown in, being from the from India and from that Asian region and such. But is that pretty much right? Like, there's, you know, it's sort of doing the same thing that the rest of the world's kind of doing.
Yeah, yes and no, again, because, you know, it goes back to the same kind of thing, that India is a very vast country with a very varied audience. So, you know, the social and the economic factors play a large part in the consumption of music and the kind of music consumed. In fact, if I'm not mistaken, the biggest music that is consumed in India is Bollywood music, which is our film industry, which is one of the biggest in the world. And it's a completely star-driven industry, you know, style over substance, if you ask me. and that actually, yeah, in fact, that actually dominates everything in this country. Like, Bollywood is, it does nothing that matches the scale of Bollywood, except for religious things, you know. That's the, like, those are the two biggest things in India. So in terms of actual consumption of music, yeah, you would probably find that Bollywood, other film music, so there are different regional cinema, and there's also spiritual and religious music, which is what I think is probably the largest consumed music across the country. But if you change the demographic of the audience to the more city-driven, slightly better off financially group of people, yes, you are looking at a group that follows the global trends of music. So if Nicki Minaj is trending in America, she's probably trending in India as well. But the question is, who is she trending with, you know? That's a different story.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that you mentioned the sort of religious style of music, because obviously, being from Australia, the second anyone says religious music to me, I think Hillsong. I imagine it's a bit different over there. What sort of stuff are we talking over there that's what you would call religious or spiritual music?
lots of basically like chants. And I mean, again, I haven't actually myself listened to a lot of this stuff because it's, I mean, being an atheist, I really like to stay away from this. Mm-hmm. But there are a lot of devotional albums by, like, it's just, I don't know what you would call in Europe, like folk music, you know, traditional folk music.
Okay.
So I guess, you know, because again, even here, religion is so massive in terms of the smaller kinds of faiths and, you know, the special sects of people. So mm-hmm. they all have like, they're like a gazillion, like the catalog for this stuff is ridiculous. Mm. You know, it's a lot of prayers and a lot of chants and all that stuff. All that falls under religious music, you know?
I mean, for someone who's obviously grown up, you grew up in one of the major metropoles, didn't you?
Yeah.
So, I mean, you probably wouldn't have had as much exposure or, say, less exposure, I would say, than someone who, say, grew up in, you know, what we call a rural area, you know, or an area that's, you know, mostly farms and so on and so forth. But it still boggles the mind, always boggles the mind to me when someone becomes a metalhead or they become interested in that kind of music because in Australia, for me, my journey was very personal in that it very much helped me get through some pretty rough times at school and all that sort of stuff and Linkin Park. And, you know, they were basically singing about the outcasts, which was people like myself. You know,
yeah.
How did you get into it? I read somewhere that someone essentially gave you Metallica and Iron Maiden and it kind of stuck.
Yeah, so I had it's a odd story because I first heard Iron Maiden on a school trip. Mm-hmm. A friend of mine gave me Iron Maiden's debut album, Iron Maiden. Mm-hmm. And I remember listening to Running Free and just being blown away by that. And then followed that was Phantom of the Opera, which mm-hmm. my brain was having trouble wrapping my head around, but it sounded so good. Mm-hmm. But there was a bit of a break after that where I actually didn't listen to any metal because mm-hmm. I don't know why I didn't follow through on that at that time. Mm-hmm. But about 2 years later, I made some other friends in school, just the same circle kind of grew a bit bigger. Mm-hmm. And they gave me Metallica and stuff and said, you know, stop listening to the rubbish you're listening to, which was Spice Girls and Backstreet Boys at the time. I took it home. I listened to it, you know, and next thing you know, I'm diving deep into death and black metal and they are telling me to turn off the noise. It was quite funny, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting you mentioned Spice Girls, Backstreet Boys and all that. I mean, everyone has a vice, right? Has a like a hidden musical love. Mine's less than hidden. I actually quite enjoy the Backstreet Boys, which I'm certain there's a lot of prog people that are probably going to rock up at my house with pitchforks and torches for saying that. But it is interesting that that's kind of, you know, that was the norm, and then you had this underground kind of stuff of metal and so on and so forth, and the metal ended up winning. I mean, what was it particularly that won you over in the end? You know, was it the guitar tones? Was it the fact that it just didn't have anything different? Or was it the fact that they were kind of saying they actually had something to say rather than, ooh, baby, you know, stay the night at mine, yeah, like that kind of stuff?
I think it's all of it, really, you know? Like, obviously, in the start, it's just the sound of the guitars, the drums, the aggression, the voice. And then at the same time, you have, you know, like, I guess listening to songs like Fade to Black, which is so melodic. And mm-hmm. And then, of course, you know, I guess when you are a teenager, you do feel, like you said, you know, the outcast. And just that kind of sort of relief comes from metal, knowing mm-hmm. that you kind of are not the only one. And mm-hmm. I guess all of it just kind of connected. And I think that's probably still what, till this day, connects kids to metal, you know, like mm-hmm. that age kind of is one that sort of draws you in when you feel like an outcast, like you don't belong, and, you know, school and college and you're going mm-hmm. through puberty and all that. And yep. life is confusing. And metal kind of provides you that sort of support, you know, and mm-hmm. yeah, I don't know. And I guess I've always been someone who, you know, who likes to follow his own path and not conform to society's ideas. And I think metal kind of just spoke to that part of me as well.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. I think that is also. So it's I guess, a mixture of, you know, pretty much everything. And the skill, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Also the fact that well, at least at the time before I had much musical knowledge, every other kind of music seemed like it didn't require much skill, you know. And like metal just seemed a lot more skillful. Of course, you know, as I grew up and I learned more about music and I got into production and I worked in the studio and I saw other kinds of music being created, obviously my views changed. But yeah, I mean, all those factors got me into metal and I think have kept me here till this day.
It's interesting that you mentioned, you know, that you picked up on what I said there about, you know, feeling like a bit of an outcast, and, you know, a lot of people seem to do that. In preparation for this interview, because I'll be really honest with you, I know just about four-fifths of fuck all about the metal scene over in India and the music scene as such in India as well. But it seems from some of the stuff that I read over the last couple of days, that a lot of the younger metal bands that are coming through are starting to almost become a little bit more, I don't want to use the word activist, but they're sort of, their lyrics and such are more about, you know, pushing against the norm, and particularly some of the norms in inverted commas that you might find in India, things like, you know, government corruption and, you know, the kind of stuff that people are seeing as a little bit unjust over there. I mean, has this been a growing thing in India for the last few years? And I mean, what exactly are these people writing about, if you know?
Is there any particular band that you're referring to, or it's just a general?
It seems to be a general thing of some of the new, particularly in that sort of deathcore, you know, bands like, what are they called? Parkway Drive and Polaris from Australia, like that kind of music, you know, the guys who really actually write sort of 4-minute pop songs, but they're really actually just amazing metal musicians.
I don't know. I mean, I think in India, it's I haven't really paid attention to too many bands' lyrics because, you know, I mean, they're all very different. But there are certain bands that have written against situations and about, you know, more current events and stuff like that. But it's not particular. It's not like a specific thing. I guess there are always bands that wrote about this stuff, you know. Like, it's just, it's, the scene is very small. So I don't, I mean, or it's not, well, not such a, like, it's not something that's been so obvious to me, at least. You know, there are bands that definitely do write about it, and there are bands that write about, I guess, other shit, you know, whatever's going on. But there are a couple of bands, I guess. I guess there is the thrash band from Bombay called Carnage Inc. That wrote some stuff, and there's a band called Heathen Beast from Calcutta. And yeah, there are a couple of bands that are writing stuff. But again, like I said, it's, I don't think it's like a big wave of bands. I think bands in general write about whatever means something to them, you know?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, arguably we have the same sort of thing going on here with bands. A lot of bands at the moment are writing about, you know, the isolation that they're feeling with coronavirus and, you know, sort of everything that's going on in Australia, so far as, you know, all the crazy stuff that's happening down in Melbourne and all that sort of stuff. So, you know, you are a product of your environment at the end of the day. One thing I did pick up on a little bit earlier as well was that you said that, you know, you kind of liked the noise of the metal, you know, metal being just generally speaking a very noisy genre. Was that partly, do you think, and maybe you haven't thought about this, but was it partly, maybe, do you think, the fact that you would have grown up in such a noisy environment, you know, growing up in a major metropole in India, which by all accounts is always sort of shown as a bit of a just a madhouse, you know, when you're on the roads and all that kind of stuff. It was, it a way to drown that out almost, or, you know, did it add to it, you know?
No, I don't think so, because I guess the other thing is you don't really feel it's as noisy when you're growing up, because it's normal for you. It's only actually when you visit another place do you suddenly feel the silence that you don't, that you're not used to, you know. And I had traveled very infrequently, I guess, in as a kid. I mean, we only really went to Dubai. But I remember when I went to Europe, And I was at a festival in Czech Republic, and we were in a hotel that was some wayward place. Like, I could hear myself breathe in the night. I was having trouble sleeping because it was so quiet.
Wow.
And like, I remember when I also interviewed Carnivool from Australia.
Yeah.
I interviewed for my them for my show. I think that was a realization of how quiet Australia must be, because they were like, the way they spoke is like almost in whispers, but Indians are normally much louder. And I was like, you know, I started to notice these differences, but I don't think it was to drown out any noise that liked metal. In fact, I think a lot of metal bands sounded like noise to me, and I didn't get it in the first listen. And it's only like, I remember hearing Cannibal Corpse for the first time, and I could not make out head or tail of the music. It just sounded like noise. And today, Cannibal Corpse is, well, you know, is the softer end of the death metal spectrum, sonically speaking, you know. Like, and when I say softer spectrum, I just mean in terms of, if you play a Cannibal Corpse record from 1990 and you play a Tech Death album from today, you'll realize that that sounds less like a wall of noise than the newer stuff, because it's also compressed and enhanced and, you know, just like in your face. So yeah. that's
The loudness wars, right?
Yeah
they've not been kind to music.
But even production, I mean, the layering of drum samples, everything quantized to the grid, and, you know, everything made to sound fat and full, and it just basically, it's a different experience, you know. It like, it actually gives you, like I'll tell you what, if anyone's listening, take the Cannibal Corpse album, The Bleeding, and just play that next to Infant Annihilator's latest album, and you'll know exactly what I'm talking about.
I'll have to do that.
You know, it's not about good or bad. It's just, yeah, and it's not about good or bad. And like, they're both good albums, but I'm just saying the sonic difference is massive.
No, I think it is interesting. I mean, even if you go back and you listen to sort of the stuff from Metallica in the you know, mid 80s through to sort of the early 90s, and then you compare it to their much later stuff, so Hardwired or what was that one? Yeah. Death Magnetic. Oh, God, that was a horrible album. You know, it was also compressed and weird. I remember there being something about the Death Magnetic album. People were trying to get their hands on the Guitar Hero tracks for it because it was actually mixed a lot nicer than, because it wasn't peaking and so on and so forth like the other one was, because it was just compressed to the shit house. It's such an interesting concept for me, because for all intents and purposes, India seems to be quite a conservative country, in that there's still quite a lot of religious influence, and, you know, I'd imagine that metal is somewhat, you know, frowned upon. But it's kind of the same here as well, in that despite that we like to think of ourselves as a progressive nation, you know, it's, but the irony is it's usually metal musicians who are saying things like, take care of one another, don't be an asshole. I've seen more metal musicians stop shows to get people picked up in the pit than I have in pop, you know, popular forms of music. And, you know, the pop forms of music are usually the more derogatory styles, particularly when it comes to talking about women and so on and so forth. Do you think the message is kind of lost in the fact that it just seems to be really aggressive music?
Not really. I mean, look, I think with metal also, there is good and bad in terms of bands that have good lyrical content, some which is just downright ghastly. I mean, you're seeing more and more metal bands being called out who are quite racist in their agenda. And if you actually look at the entire grindcore and that whole underground sort of grind, porno grind scene, it's very derogatory to women. And like, if you look at every single metal artwork, it shows torture of women. I mean, look, you know, the world is changing, but that is a sort of imagery that's often used in metal. Like we have, as personal experiences, maybe we haven't experienced, but if you look, I've seen a lot of bad stuff go down in the metal space from people. And it's not just in India, it's globally. Like, I'm on a lot of Facebook groups, and the toxicity is very, very real, you know. And the thing is, I feel metalheads have reached this point where they have this sort of holier-than-thou attitude of, like, you know, we're superior because we like metal, and when they're not really, you know. Like, if you look at most of these go-grind artists, the subject matter of the person is always a woman with her vagina torn open or her backside ripped apart. And I mean, yeah, okay, you know, maybe 20 years ago nobody thought about these things because, you know, nobody spoke about privilege and misogyny and all that, but now it's time to sort of change a little bit, I feel like. So yeah, and I mean, in India, I mean, how many right-wing metalheads have I come across who are just blatantly racist, Islamophobic? It's crazy. Like, basically, what I realize is metalheads are exactly like normal people for the most part, in the sense that they have the same prejudices, they have the same, like, messed up beliefs. I mean, of course, there are many who don't, but, you know, if you fall in the pit, you get picked up, you know? But, yeah, there's a lot of things metalheads like to sort of brush under the rug. Like, I know, because I've been to a few conferences and I've heard women starting to speak out about, like, you know, yeah, we've gotten groped at gigs and we've had bad experiences here. But metalheads are like, no, you know, it's a one-off thing. Metalheads are brothers. Nobody will do that. Like, there's a bit of that denial of, you know, the fact that, yeah, there's a lot of shit that needs fixing here as well, you know. Oh, yeah, but what I can say is, you know what? Metalheads aren't always as scary as they look. I mean, they're not as, what's that word? Well, they're often nicer than they look. You know, people see us with tattoos. Well, not us. I don't have any tattoos. But, like, they see people with tattoos and long hair, they automatically assume, you know, it's somebody who's going to stab you in the back alley. But that's far from the truth, you know. Metalheads are just people like anyone else.
Yeah, absolutely. Hear, hear. I mean, I'm the same, right? I don't have any tattoos, mostly because I'm afraid of needles. But you know, you're right. I mean, some of the nicest people I know are people that are covered in tattoos, and they've got, you know, they play. I remember going to see this band. I cannot remember the name of them for the life of me now. But a mate of mine invited me along, and it was kind of like a Cannibal Corpse-y kind of thing, which honestly is not my shtick, right?
Yeah.
But I went, and it was a pretty good night. It was really fun. And this guy gets up, and he would have been, I mean, 6'4", 6'5", big dude, shaved head, piercings, tattoos everywhere, like tattoos over his head, all this kind of stuff. Anyway, after the show, turns out it was my mate's mate. And he was like, oh, hey, you know, Rich, this is Dave. And I've gone, g'day, man. How you going? He's like, yeah, I'm really well, man. How are you? And we ended up having beers and just talking about, like, physics and philosophy and such. And it was the funniest thing. Like, if you had walked into this tiny little venue in Sydney and you just would have seen these guys who you would probably have thought, like, I was a prisoner of or something. But, you know, it was really interesting. You mentioned there that there are obviously some pretty toxic things that happen on, particularly online and things like that, but particularly against women and so on and so forth. I mean, is it particularly prevalent, do you think, in the metal community because people are so willing just to kind of say that it doesn't happen?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's as prevalent as anywhere else, you know, like it's, I'm just like, I think metalheads, yeah, I mean, a lot of them don't think it happens because they don't know anyone who it's happened to. And I think this is true for everything in the world. Like, you know, there are so many men who just, and I was one of them, you know, you think that, oh, you know, like, cause I come from a family where my mom has not had any bad experiences, or at least none that she's told me of being a woman, but it's, and so I would never assume that it's tough to be a woman. And why is it hard to be a woman in India, for example? And it's only when I started actually having women friends who spoke to me and told me about their real life experiences, and you watch them actually break down in front of you, then you kind of realize that, you know, shit, like, I don't think of this because it's not an issue for me. You know, I can walk out at 10 p.m. in the night and I don't have to worry about being raped and groped and, you know, like anything happening to me, you know. I don't have to worry about creepy relatives molesting me at a family gathering. Like, it's, and it's because a lot of these metalheads just come for gigs. They see four or five women with their boyfriends and they don't ever understand what happens. So they don't know. But the more people start speaking about it and the more, I guess, they have someone who they know personally tell them about it, then they start to believe it, maybe. You know, it's almost like the COVID thing. So many people going on about conspiracy theories and stuff. And then the moment somebody next to them gets it, then they're like, okay, you know what? Maybe it's not a conspiracy theory, because I know someone who has it now. You know?
Absolutely. So you think it's a case of it doesn't happen because I haven't seen it kind of thing. It's like, yeah, it's almost like plausible deniability.
Yeah, it's like how people talk about anything in this world for that matter. Oh, because it's not my problem, that means it's not a problem for anyone. But, you know, you've never had somebody else's experience, so you can't always, you know, speak for them. And it's about just sort of opening your mind and saying, you know what, okay, you know, this is your truth and this is what happens and I need to understand that.
Yeah, absolutely. Very, very salient point. I mean, we kind of see it here, and I'm sure there's stuff that we don't see that happens. You know, I've got a good friend of mine. We were at a gig. I think it was the Mike Portnoy Shattered Fortress show, actually, from memory. And her and I were on the railing, and this guy just sort of came up beside her and put his arm around her and put his hand on her tit, right? And now, I don't know if it was accidental. Maybe it was. I don't know. I the fact was, though, he sort of kept it there. And
yeah, that's not accidental, dude.
Mine was just like, she didn't know what to do. And that was the part that kind of annoyed me the most out of all of it, you know, because as a bloke, you know, someone does that to you. If someone just walked up to you and sort of grabbed your balls, you wouldn't sort of be paralyzed and not know what to do. You'd probably be like, well, dude, what the fuck are you doing? You know what I mean? And it just seems that people get paralyzed by that.
Who would have been paralyzed by that? Like, you know, not everyone is I mean, like, I'm not a very confrontational guy and I'm not a big, strong dude. I mean, tomorrow if some big fucking guy comes and grabs me, I may not know what to do. Like, it happens, you know, it can happen to anyone and it's not okay. You know, there's no, it was a mistake. It's not, you should not, there's no excuse for it. It just ends there. That is not acceptable.
No, I agree with you.
That's like saying, you know, oh, I have a knife in my hand, let me stab you. Oops, accident. You're dead now.
No, it's a very, very, very salient point.
Like bumping into someone is an accident. You know, you're trying to walk somewhere and you bump into them. That's an accident. Putting your hand on someone's tit is not an accident. We all know that.
No, it is interesting that those sorts of things do occur. And I mean, I saw it firsthand and sort of went, what was that about? You know? You're exactly right. I mean, it's not something that you'd ever think that happens, but it probably happens much more than we would like to admit that it does. I don't know. Look, let's leave that sort of topic there. And talking about that, let's change gears a bit. And let's talk about what was kind of your side project and is now kind of your mainstay, Headbangers Kitchen.
Yes.
So for the uninitiated of you, you mentioned a little bit earlier that you now do a YouTube thing, which is sort of all around keto recipes and so on and so forth, which is how I found you, because I've started doing a low carb thing myself. And by the way, it works and it's awesome. And your recipes are fucking fantastic. That comes from me and my girlfriend. She absolutely loves them. And as do I, they're absolutely awesome. When and why did it start, though? How did you go from being, you know, the Cookie Monster vocal man from a really, really good metal band to, hey, I'm going to start like a cooking show?
Yeah. So, okay. You'll have to rewind a little bit to my childhood. Sure. I was a fat kid. I loved food. And I was quite a finicky eater. So I guess I started cooking somewhere around the age of, I think, 10 years old, maybe. Mm-hmm. And I actually wanted to be a chef when I was about 12 years old. And I had taken cooking as a hobby in school. We had an option to take like a hobby class. Mm-hmm. And I actually wanted to become a chef. Of course, you know, given my rapidly changing interests, you know, mm-hmm. I went from chef to computer engineer, mm-hmm. and finally metal musician, mm-hmm. After school got over. But obviously, I never stopped cooking because you never stop eating, right? You have to eat.
Of course, yeah.
So I guess I just continued cooking, you know, when bands would come over to stay at my house when they had a gig in my city and stuff, mm-hmm. I would feed them breakfast. And I got a bit of a reputation for being a good cook and, you know, making great omelets. That mm-hmm. was my sort of signature dish, the demonic omelet. yeah.
What I made it demonic? Was it hot sauce?
No. Basically, everything I do is branded around demonic resurrection. So everything okay. is demonic because of that. So, yeah, that's why demonic omelet. So anyway, I continued cooking. And I think it was about 2007. I was given the gift of a camera phone by my girlfriend, mm-hmm. who's now my wife. Mm-hmm. And I just... One night I was cooking dinner. I took a picture of the dish. I uploaded the recipe on Facebook and I kind of started this little food blog. Mm. And I did this for about 3 years. And at the same time, YouTube started to become fairly popular. Mm-hmm. And in India also, the internet connections had started to improve. We got some broadband connections, mm-hmm. and watching YouTube was a thing now. Mm-hmm. So I had been watching a lot of cooking videos, particularly Epic Meal Time,
yep,
which was this crazy cooking show, and these guys in America called the Barbecue Pit Boys.
Yes.
And I was starting to really get into making my own burgers, and I was doing a dish called the Bacon Bomb and stuff like that. And mm-hmm. I liked the idea of video recipes. Mm. So when Demonic Resurrection shot our first music video in 2010, I asked the director, who was a friend of mine, I said, look, I've been thinking about making video recipes because I was doing this blog on Facebook. I was like, I want to do a video recipe. Do you think you could help me shoot it? Mm. And he was like, yeah, sure. You know, but I mean, you just want to do a recipe. Like, let's do something a little more interesting. Mm. And so I brainstormed. And I thought, okay, I'll do like a heavy metal cooking show where I cook a dish, I'll interview a band, and the dish will be named after the band or a song of theirs, and then they can taste the dish at the end of the interview.
Okay.
And yeah, with my keyboard player, I came up with the name Headbanger's Kitchen, and do my cooking, and this would be great promotion for the band as well, because you know, you come and watch Headbanger's Kitchen, you see this guy hosting the show, you figure out he has a band, and you listen to his band, you know, because pretty much everything I've done in my life since I was 16 has been centered around demonic resurrection music. So this was just a natural sort of extension of that, and it was using something that I quite enjoyed cooking, and the idea would also be great that you'd bring in people who like cooking, and then they hopefully like metal and they'll check out your band. So it's a win-win situation. So that's how I started the show, and to make the long story short, I ran it in that avatar, so to speak, for about 4 years. And after 4 years, I got quite tired of doing it because the growth was very minimal and there was literally no money from the show as well. Not that I did it for the money, but I mean, when you do something, the way I see it is either you got to build an audience or have people watching it, or you got to make money. Something has to motivate you to do it. And for me, I had lost the motivation to do it purely for the joy of it, because it was a lot of work. And I was like, you know, I can spend the same amount of time on the band instead, you know. So I said, you know what? And because I used to shoot with a proper production team and lights, it required a lot of moving furniture in my house, bringing out an electric, so the bringing out a gas stove and a cylinder and all this crazy stuff. So I was like, look, I'm just going to abandon the show now, and I'm going to focus on making music. And you know what, if I have a recipe and I want to shoot it, I'll shoot it on my own with one camera in the kitchen. Because by now, given the amount of people that had worked on the show, I had invested in a camera myself. So I was like, okay, and I'll do a simple setup where I can just edit it easily, because I can't get into downloading some heavy editing software and do some 4 or 5 different camera angles. So I was like, keep it simple, keep it cool, and do it. So I started doing that. And since I was on keto and I was eating cauliflower pizza and zucchini spaghetti, I was like, I have to film this. And so I did. I did film a few keto recipes. I put it up. I started to get some great feedback. After that first little 4 or 5 keto recipes that I did, I actually went vegan. I did some non-keto recipes. I started bringing back some band guys to interview, but in a more casual setting in my kitchen. But the sort of demand for keto recipes was constantly there. Like every third comment was like, hey, man, looking forward to more keto recipes. And since I got back on keto myself, I was like, you know what, let's do this. And then it kind of just, I found the USP, like keto was my thing. And then I just sort of stuck to the recipes and I did that. And here I am today doing YouTube as a full-time job.
I mean, it's so good to see. I agree with you, for starters, video recipes are totally the best way to go. because you can see the consistency, right? You can see, okay, that's what goes in there. And this is what it should look like. And, you know, it's nice to have that voiceover as well explain, like, for example, on your butter chicken recipe, right? It looks far more pale than what I would expect as a butter chicken. And you're like, okay, but it's due to this and this and this, so don't worry about it. It's still going to taste great. And it does, by the way. It tastes fucking phenomenal.
Thank you.
I wanted to ask you a bit of a question about some of the curry recipes and so on and so forth, and what I would call the Indian recipes that you do. I mean, are these based on a more traditional recipe? Because that butter chicken that I had did not taste like what I would expect butter chicken to taste like here in Australia. You know, I think we've got more that like Birmingham, British, Indian diner sort of thing, whereas I'm guessing you're sort of basing it more on what a traditional butter chicken would be.
Oh, yeah, of course, because, you know, like Chinese food, Indian food sort of tastes different in every country that you eat it in, you know, depending on who's cooking it. Like in the UK, half the Indian restaurants have Bangladeshi cooks, you know, and the Indian food served in pubs is totally different from what you get in India. So, and I'm sure it's the same in America and Australia as well, you know, and there are different kind of versions of Indian food, you know. Obviously, for you know, non-Indians, it's often toned down in spices, you know, which I like, but then it doesn't have the same flavor. The produce is different. So the tomatoes that you would get in the UK versus the tomatoes you get in India make a big difference. So same with the onions, same with most of the stuff. But yeah, so my stuff, I generally try and find the most authentic sort of, or the closest, because obviously even in India there are variations in dishes and it tastes different where if you eat it in a different restaurant. So I try and find like what I think is the most cohesive version, and of course then I adjust it to fit the keto lifestyle.
No, it's really good, and you've got absolutely amazing recipes on there, including your desserts, by the way. That peanut butter cheesecake thing looks amazing. I haven't tried it yet. I will endeavor to do that at some point over the next few weekends. It's really interesting hearing your story about cooking, because it's sort of a little bit similar to mine as well, in that I started cooking from a young age, mostly due to necessity, because both my parents worked. So, you know, it started off with, hey, can you get the steak out of the freezer too? Can you make a salad too? Can you just cook dinner?
Nice.
And then I got into cooking in a big way in 2016. I had a stroke, and my girlfriend at the time was a nurse, and she said, you know, hey, just do your writing, focus on your journalism, and get a hobby. So I was like, well, I've always liked cooking. So I started watching a lot of videos online. So, you know, Gordon Ramsay particularly was a big one for me. And, you know, talking about, you know, then got into smoking meats and all that kind of stuff. So built my own drum smoker and all that sort of stuff. So it's really interesting to hear the similarities, and food is such a unifying thing. When you said, you know, you had bands stay over at your place, I've done that, you know, and then in the morning cook them breakfast and all that sort of stuff. So I've done exactly what it is. So it's really hilarious to hear sort of hold the mirror up almost, you know.
Yeah.
You know, but diet is such an important thing too. And I mean, if you don't mind my asking, why did you go on keto? Was it to lose weight? Was it to, you know, get away from, you know, carbs or something like that? What was it that brought you to do it?
It was the weight loss because honestly, to me, first of all, I'd never ever thought of carbs as bad. And even today, I don't think of carbs as a bad food at all. But I wanted to lose weight and keto seemed to provide the easiest way to do it with the least amount of effort, in the sense that a friend of mine had done keto and he lost 30 kilos just by eating keto food. He was eating whatever he wanted, just he was not eating carbs. And the thing is, I hate exercising, or rather I hated exercising. Well, okay, I don't like exercising even today, but
no one likes getting hot and sweaty, man. It's just, you know.
Yeah, so my girlfriend actually was the one who called up my friend, got all the details from him, did her own research, because she hates exercising too and she wanted to lose weight. So she did keto first. In fact, I was telling them both that they were going to get heart attacks and die. So, because obviously, you know, you've grown up thinking that fat is bad and fat is the devil and fat is the enemy. So, I mean, what could possibly be wrong with carbs, you know? What could possibly
it's
be wrong
group,
with what
right?
you
it's
eat?
It's like, it's on the pyramid. It's got to be good.
Yeah, I mean, I don't even think we ever saw a pyramid, but just generally, like, you know, from your house, like, okay, don't have too much sugar, don't have too much oil, don't have too much butter, you know, shift over to margarine, et cetera, et cetera. Same stuff. So anyway, I was a naysayer till I saw her lose 10 kilos in 3 months on keto. And then I was like, you know what? You lost weight without moving from the chair. I'm going to do this as well. So I did it purely for weight loss. And honestly, even to tell you the truth, to this day, I don't face any like bad effects of eating carbs. Like I've gone on and off keto a fair amount, you know. But definitely, like, my perspective obviously has changed from 4 years ago when I started keto. But I definitely see keto and generally eating healthy makes sense. Now, how to eat healthy? There are a variety of ways to do it. You know, I don't believe that there's one diet that works for everybody. But yeah, I definitely believe you need to look at food as a sort of nourishment for your body rather than just eating whatever comes your way.
Absolutely. I think it's so key. And I think a lot of musos sort of overlook it as well. I mean, the amount of gigs I've been to, and I've been guilty of it as well. You know, you finish up a gig, it's midnight, you're driving home and you're like, fuck it, I'll just pull into Macca's and get something, you know, or you grab a kebab or something on the way home, and you wake up in the morning and you feel like shit. You just feel awful. And I don't think it's because it's just purely because of what you're eating.
I mean, a McDonald's meal is about 1,200 calories if you have everything. So it's not necessarily 1,200 great calories, you know?
No. It was really interesting. I'm a big sucker for fried chicken, right? I love fried chicken. Like I'm on the hunt at the moment to find the best fried chicken in Sydney. I'm pretty sure I've found it, but so all that's kind of been on pause for the last couple of months because I started keto at the start of July as well. So it's kind of on pause. But I was looking up out of curiosity the carb content of a KFC meal. And I was like, oh, I wonder what it is. The chicken itself ain't that bad. It's about 7 grams of carbs or something for a piece of chicken, which if you're trying to stay under 20 grams of carbs a day, which is what I'm doing, it's not too bad. You can have a couple of bits and then that's sort of about it. But the chips murder you. And it's really interesting changing your opinion on that kind of stuff. And, you know, dad's a big fan of fish and chips and things like that. So he'll bring fish and chips home, or, you know, chicken and chips for lunch or something like that. He's not unhealthy, by the way. He weighs less than I do. And I'm not that heavy. But it's the chips, it's getting out of that craving for the carbs as well, which is the really hard thing that I've found. And I'm still struggling with it a little bit, to be really honest with you.
Yeah, and it's not easy. Like, it depends on your relationship with food. Like, there are a lot of people who eat with a purpose and they don't really look at food as an enjoyment. Mm-hmm. Like, it's just, okay, I can eat whatever I need to eat because eating is just a function. But mm-hmm. yeah, like, for me, every time if I've gone off keto, like, I'm currently not doing keto because I live with my mom and dad, and I'm basically the cook now in the house because mm-hmm. I have to cook for, well, I don't cook, but I cook enough that I'm like, I can't cook another separate meal for myself. I might as well just eat what everyone's eating.
Yep.
You know, and it's not necessarily that carbs are unhealthy. It just depends what carbs you're eating. Yeah, mm-hmm. like you said, you know, a packet of French fries once in a month is not going to do you harm. But if that's your every weekend meal, that is going to start to, you know, do some kind of, well, it's definitely not doing you any good, that's for sure, you know.
Yeah, I mean, nothing's really bad for you in moderation, except arsenic maybe, but, you know.
Yeah.
it's really fascinating. And I do want to mention as well a little bit here that the whole idea of the Headbanger's Kitchen, I mean, that was one of the things that initially attracted me to your recipes, was the fact that you called it Headbanger's Kitchen. I was like, all right, so this is going to be at least interesting to watch, you know. And then when I realized you actually knew what you were doing as well, I was like, oh, okay, now this is different. And I started by some of the desserts, and I've made quite a few of the curries and the paneers and things like that as well.
Nice.
And it's awesome. It's so good. Have you thought about putting out a cookbook or anything like that?
I actually have 3 cookbooks out.
There you go. So my research was clearly not that great.
So I first did a cookbook called, I've actually forgotten the name of that cookbook. Well, basically, that's not my cookbook, so to speak. I just edited a bunch of recipes for this publisher, and I gave them 10 dessert recipes. Mm-hmm. I think that book is called The Keto Diet Cookbook or something like that.
Okay. Yeah.
And then I did a quick keto cookbook, easy keto recipes, it's called. Again, for that book, I gave them 30 recipes and photos. So the book is not full of my recipes. Mm-hmm. But I think September 2018 was when my own cookbook came out. Mm-hmm. This is with my 100 best recipes. And this one is called Keto Life.
Okay.
And it's available all over the world. So you'll get it in Australia, you'll get it in America, you'll get it in the Philippines, you'll get it in Japan, wherever you want.
Awesome. And do you have any others that are in the works, anything coming out soon?
No, I have not planned anything yet, but I do know that if I do another keto cookbook, it will be an Indian recipe cookbook. Because the first one that I've done, Keto Life, which is my 100 best recipes, is basically just the 100 best recipes I've ever done. You know, so it's got all the breads, the desserts, the main courses, but it's only got like 2 Indian recipes, so to speak. But the next one that I do, if I do one, because I'd probably like to wait for a good offer before I do another book.
Of course,
But yeah, if I do another one, it'll be an Indian only cookbook, like 100 best Indian keto recipes.
But I tell you what, I would buy the shit out of that. Because I love making curries and things like that, partly because it's such a good share meal. And I'm a big fan of making food for not just for myself, but for, you know,
for everyone. Yeah,
exactly. For everyone. And they can all enjoy it and all that kind of stuff. So it's really, really interesting. That's what you're doing. And I'm going to have to buy one of your cookbooks now. Now, with all this stuff that's been going on with the Headbanger's Kitchen and so on and so forth, your personal music career, I mean, is that still going? Are you sort of backing off a little bit on it? You haven't given up, I hope.
Oh, no. So I already did the whole I'm done with this 2 years ago and never got done with it. So I I'm a bit emo that way, you know. But yeah, 2 years back, I kind of got a little fed up with the music scene and I kind of said I'm good to call it quits. Mm-hmm. And I did a farewell show and then I did another farewell show and then I did two tours in the UK and then did another tour last year. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, so I guess I'm still here and I, in fact, just started writing a brand new EP, awesome. Which should come out later this year.
Oh, fantastic. You'll have to flick us the link for that so we can link to it.
When you'll be able to find everything on my Bandcamp page, which is demonstealer.bandcamp.com. Mm-hmm. And all the Demonic Resurrection stuff is on demonicresurrection.bandcamp.com. And of course, everything will be on Spotify, Apple Music, Deezer, Tidal, etc., etc., etc.
All the stuff, all the everything that you need to be on these days.
Yeah, and otherwise people can always find everything on headbangerskitchen.com because on the right-hand side of the website, there's a Spotify playlist with all my music as well.
That's so good. Oh, man, it's amazing. This is one of the reasons why I like using your recipes because I can look up the recipe and I can listen to some decent music while I'm doing it.
definitely.
All right. Look, Sahil, we're sort of coming to the end of this. There is one final question that I would love to ask you, and that is you've done a lot of interviews over your career. You've done a lot of from both sides, you know, and you're very experienced in the music industry and so on and so forth. But what's a question that you've never been asked that you would have actually liked someone to ask you? So, you know, those questions where you're like, I've got the perfect answer for this and no one ever asks you it. What's the question and give me the answer.
You know, the bad news is I don't think I've ever had a question because I don't think I've ever thought about interviews that much. Mm. I've just been like, okay, I've got to do this. This is happening. That's why like people are like, oh, I'll send you the questions. I'm like, just don't bother. Just ask me whatever you want on the spot. Because I'm more of a like just on the fly kind of guy. So like, you know, I don't need to prep for an interview. Just ask me whatever you want. I'll say what's on my mind and I'll forget about it and go on to the next thing that I need to do, you know. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I've never been like, oh, I hope somebody asks me. I mean, but I guess what I enjoy is if interviewers are asking me like sort of in-depth questions about the music, specifically, of course, if that is what the purpose of the interview is, like, you know, like tell me a little bit about this song or this lyric or like, I guess that is what I really do enjoy, I guess. And of course, then there are always interviewers who do like these rapid fire rounds, like pick between this and this, something like that. So those are always fun to do as well.
No, it's an interesting world, the old journalism world. So look, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for answering my Facebook email. And
my pleasure, man.
You know, all that. It's been a blast talking to you about, you know, your band, the music scene, India, and of course food, because food is awesome. So look, Sahil, thank you so much for joining us here on the 9-8 podcast.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Hey, look, thank you for joining us.
All right, my pleasure.
Well, there you have it, guys. Thank you so much for tuning in to our interview with Sahil, Demon Stealer, all the way from India. If you really enjoyed this interview, then please consider becoming a Patreon subscriber for just $3 a month. You go some of the way to helping us keep this show on the air. Now, next time, Hoggy's going to be sitting down with one of the boys from Mayora to talk to them all things about the Sydney music and prog scene and just music in general. Until next time, thank you so much for tuning in. My name's David Ellis. We'll see you on the next one. Stay safe.
The 9-8 interview.